welcome back for another installment of Fellowship of the Rink. And I'm joined this week by the athletic Minnesota duo of Joe Smith and Joe Smith's backup, Michael Russo.
What's up? How are you?
We're doing all right. And apologies, that's a joke for anyone. That was Russo's username, allegedly, yeah. Coming in here.
Do I normally look this old, or have I just gotten unbelievably old? I look like a relic of what I used to look like.
From the photo that's in the press box in Sunrise in the Panthers arena. Like, Scott, yeah. I don't know if you've seen it, the picture of him. It's like he was like in his early 20s, maybe, or like when was that picture taken?
Well, I don't know when that was taken, but I started covering them at 21. Yeah, so I wish they would get a new picture. Actually, I don't want the picture this old. I'll pick the picture that they could put up.
My wife's a graphic designer. I'll have her mock it up for you. No worries.
Yeah.
I got to ask off of that too. Like, I know obviously you guys don't have any like direct allegiances, but Joe, you used to cover Tampa a lot more recently, but Russo, you on the Florida beat. Is there like any like rivalry between you two? Like looking at the series that's playing out now, like is it talked about at all, or is it just a non-event?
Non-event for me. Joe and I were joking about like how awesome would it have been if they sent both of us down there to cover the series, the old Panthers beat writer and the old Lightning beat writer. That would have been fun. Maybe if we were there, like in the middle of the grind, we'd sort of mock pretend that we were having this big, you know, like kind of like governor versus governor bet or something. You know, the other has to wear the I have to wear like a University of Michigan jersey if the Lightning win or something. I don't know.
Yeah, we can get you a JJ McCarthy Michigan jersey. You know, you can sport it around town.
My God, do I look old? I mean, truly. Like, I feel like there's a filter on me.
There is. That's what we'll go with. There's an old filter on you.
It's the lighting in this dark room, I think.
We'll call it Russo's filter. All right, got to ask you because you've been around the organization for a long time, and we ask everyone about this, but like, what did you think of the Minnesota Wild logo coming in when you first got on the beat here? Like, trees, bear, if you ask Adam Beckman, UFO, like, what did you think?
You really have to stare at it to totally understand what it is. There's so many just different things in there. The funniest thing is that a lot of people in the league, if you ask them what their favorite logo is, they actually say the Wild because it's so unique. Me, I don't know what I thought it was. Maybe a snake's head or something like that. It just, it doesn't, I don't know. It just does not, you know, somebody, I think I've actually read the story of the person that designed it, and it's certainly unique, but I definitely couldn't draw it just like the Wild players.
Man.
But I do know the name of more Minnesota cities than Brock Faber, so.
He didn't even say St. Paul or Minneapolis.
Yeah.
He used to call it,
and like Eastridge is a high school. I think he was like naming high schools, like Roosevelt, you know, like, I don't know.
I know before the Wild, you were obviously in Florida. It's kind of fun that we're both working together when we both kind of got our starts covering preps pretty much in Florida. And I was curious, like, I'm sure you told the story before, but just how you got your kind of quote big break into hockey since you've been, everybody knows you just from Russo hockey the whole time.
Yeah. I started like in the early 90s. Well, I started in the early 90s at the Sun Sentinel when I was just 15 years old ish. And then the Florida got the Sunshine Hockey League. This is before your time down there, Joe. And the Sunshine Hockey League had four teams. It was in West Palm Beach, the West Palm Beach Blaze, the Lakeville. It was the Jacksonville Bullets, the Lakeville Ice Warriors, and the Daytona Beach something or others. And so four teams. They played like a full schedule. Bill Nyrup, the late Bill Nyrup, who was from Edina, Minnesota. His dad was actually CEO of Northwest Airlines. He played for the North Stars and the Canadiens. He was commissioner of the league, but he owned the West Palm Beach franchise and was GM of the franchise and the coach of the franchise. So when I was just a teenager, I would just go up there for free for the Sun Sentinel. I'd write these like 18-inch features and articles after games and turn them in, and they'd be chopped to 2 inches. And then I'd show up the next day and write 18 inches, and they'd chop it and throw it into briefs. But Nyrup loved me, took me under his wing, really taught me the sport. You know, I was a big Islander fan growing up, but when I moved to Florida, there was no pro hockey. And then when the Panthers came to town, I was covering preps in University of Florida, University of Miami, FSU. and those first couple years. And I covered preps, as you mentioned. I was a stringing for Associated Press. Stringing is a term for freelancers that we have in the business. For Associated Press, so I would get in the press boxes of the Florida Panthers, the Miami Heat, the Dolphins, and the Marlins, and I would run quotes for Steve Wynn, who's the big AP writer down there. And 2 years after they existed in 1995, they went to the Stanley Cup Finals, and that whole year I was sort of covering practices and backup to the backup, and next thing I know, I became the beat writer. And so this is my 29th season that I just wrapped up here. 19 in Minnesota, only 10 in Florida at this point. But yeah, it was, there was an editor at the Sun Sentinel, Fred Turner, that really, gave me my first big break and allowed me to cover anything I wanted. And then Brian White came in there. He's the current sports editor at the Columbus Dispatch. And these were two of the editors that really were paved the way for me having a long career in this business.
It's always fun thinking about where you guys, everybody starts. You know, I covered like rodeos and like California and Oakdale and like high school sports in first person. And I kind of had mentors like you did, Mike, and John Lowe, a Hall of Fame baseball writer for the Tigers, was an advisor at the Michigan Daily, the student paper, and he would read our stories. Like for women's tennis, my first beat, I wrote like 15 features that first year. And then hockey was when I fell in love with it. But he let me, I used to go down to Comerica Park and like, kind of string on my weekend nights in college, and I would write my own game story. It was kind of a fake gamer. And so we both write our own game stories. His was obviously better, but we'd both write game stories, and then he would read mine afterwards. We go over like our process and what happened. And so I have a bunch of, on an old Dell computer, I probably have like 25 Tigers gamers that never made the light of day, but those things kind of help shape, get you prepared, right? Like if you cover like preps and other, you can do pretty much anything. Right?
Yeah. So I met John Lowe down at one of those National Sports Writers and Sportscaster Association years. He and I won I was Minnesota Sports Writer of the Year, and he was Michigan at the same time. And so he and I hit it off, and he does that. I mean, he now even retired, is a mentor to tons of students, I think was working down at University of Texas and things like that. And a lot of the sports, you know, Sean Shapiro is somebody that I took under my wing when he was working in Austin and going to school down there. And I would have him come up string when the Wild played the Dallas Stars the first time in the playoffs. I had him come up and he backed me up and did like Roddick Foxa stories and all that type of stuff. And then he got a job eventually at The Athletic, which I helped him get. And now he's on his own. Blake Schuster is another kid that John Lowe put me in touch with. And so I think that when you get to be our age and the amount of years that we've done this job, I think something that we try to do is pay it forward, because when I was a young sports writer, I had so many different sports writers that I looked up to, especially here that are, you know, still in the game. I mean, you know, the Jim Mathesons, the Eric Duhatchik, who works at The Athletic. Larry Brooks is somebody that, you know, he and I were joking around in the Washington dressing room today about 1998 at the Stanley Cup Finals when the cameraman hit him in the head. And let's put it that way, he didn't react very kindly to it. So we were joking about that. And his sidekick is a girl named Molly Walker, who's really young. And she, I mean, this is longer ago than she's even been alive. And we're talking about this like it was yesterday. You know, John Delapino, who's the vice president, who's basically Gary Bettman's PR guy. He's somebody that I remember, you know, in the 1997 playoff series against the Rangers that the Panthers were playing. You know, Wayne Gretzky, I was doing this big Wayne Gretzky sidebar basically at a game, and Wayne was all alone in the corner, and Delapino's just like, just go up to him, you know, just go up to him. He'll talk to you, you know, like, and here he is, one of the vice president of communications for the league all these years later, but he's somebody that I'll never forget that moment of him saying, just go up to Gretzky, be confident, you know, like that type of stuff.
Well, and I mean, you talk about how different it is now too, for some of these kids trying to get into any kind of sports career, let alone writing. Like if you guys were young writers today, do you think you'd be able to break into the industry? Is it something you'd even pursue given where things are at today?
For me, like I think it's so much easier today, but so much harder today, if that makes sense. So much easier by the fact that there's so many different avenues. You know, you can start your own blog. There's things like The Athletic now that has 300, 400 employees. You know, Bleacher Report, you know, stuff that didn't exist years ago. But years ago, like you could just get your foot in the door as a teenager and answer phone calls and do box scores and, as we used to call it, agate and things like that. So it was almost easier. And once you get your foot in the door at a newspaper back in the day, you were in it until you died. I mean, you had to do something really, really bad to get, to lose your job. And then obviously the newspaper industry has changed dramatically, where people, like, if I stayed in Florida and didn't come to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, I probably would have been laid off within a year or two. That's just how bad that that newspaper was in terms of a health standpoint at the time, how irrelevant the Panthers game at that newspaper. So it's difficult today. There's no doubt. That's why I try to, like, you know, Dylan Laux with the Hockey News and Gopher Hole. He's somebody that, like, I really try to help, because I kind of see myself in him when I was young. And you need somebody to help you get your foot in the door, because it's just so difficult now.
Yeah, like, we are in that PHWA mentorship program. I had a female writer. She's out in, like, L.A. basically, and did some college and writing. But and she's asked me how to get into it. And I'm like, usually, like, entryway back in the day would just string or, like, freelance and cover high school football on Friday nights and just do things like you did, Mike, and send two paragraphs in and this and this, and then try to find an internship in a newspaper. But those things are few and far between, but very few prep writers now for papers. Yeah. And very few internships that are paid. I think you can write as much for blogs as you want to, or figure that out. And that's great, gives you clips, but it's just hard. There's just so very few jobs now, and so more even established people who are laid off, that, yeah, I'm not sure if I would have done the same thing, you know, if I started now versus, or maybe and 5 years ago.
Yeah, the other thing is that most every old school or old sports writer started covering preps, which is the hardest thing to do, but it's how you learn how to do this business. Now there's no preps. Like, you're not getting a job, you know, like in South Florida, where I grew up, a Friday night football Sunday, a Friday night football, I mean, that Sun Sentinel probably had 25 games between Broward and Palmage County covered with stringers and things like that. Now that just doesn't happen. And so it's hard to break in. And you know, most young sports writers, probably like most young people now, they just want to wake up and be the Minnesota Vikings or the Minnesota Wild beat writer. They just want to wake up and be the CEO of a company. It just, you know, there's, you have to work your way up and work hard, but the problem is that you need those stepping stones that might not even exist anymore. So, like, you know, years ago, you know, a lot of young sports writers would start covering hockey, and it was like their way of becoming, like, you know, all right, how can I get to that next sport that I really want to cover? Where now it's just hard to get that first job, you know, right out of college, and you know, expect that you're going to be able to move up, because there's no stepping stones anymore.
I mean, you started, got the first NHL beat out in a non-traditional market with Florida. What was the first oh shit moment when you got to Minnesota and realized it was a very different fan base you were working with?
Probably the advent of Twitter in 2009. When I first got on it, that's when I'm like, oh, now they could talk right to me. some guy on Instagram just now just trashed me. So after telling him to fuck off, I blocked him. Which I'm a little grittier than Joe when it comes to that type of stuff. In terms of, like, a lot of it is social media and all that. So, like, it's just easier to get, but it was just such on a grander scale. Like, in Florida, I was able to basically be in my lane and nobody would even know who I was. They knew my name, but they didn't, like, if you're walking through the mall, they didn't know you. Now it's not that way, just because of stuff like this. Back when I was on Bally's Sports North, the number of radio and just visual things that you do, but it's just so much grander. I mean, everybody that comments on your stuff knows the sports, played the sport, has coached the sport. So it just feels like, you know, there's no pretending. There's no, like, faking that you know what you're talking about. You better know what you're talking about. For the, you know, state of Minnesota, even though, you know, obviously Joe's from Michigan and I'm from New York originally, for them to accept a couple Floridian hockey writers, so to speak, in a place where they all know this sport, I think it says everything about the respect level that people have just for wanting coverage that's quality and things like that. So it wasn't really an oh shit moment, but it definitely, you know, I came at that perfect time where all of a sudden you started to, you know, it was like the, you know, pardon the interruption, where all of a sudden sports writers were on the radio and TV and then, you know, video podcasts and things like that. And so it's just a lot bigger now. You sort of know who you're writing for, you know, like when people come to my podcast, I know who they are from years of them. They'll come up to me and tell me their Twitter name. And I'm like, oh yeah. Like, now I know who you are, because I've known them on Twitter since I started it, you know, 16 years ago.
Oh man. And I mean, with the Twitter stuff, like, I know that maybe you haven't always been like totally nice, but more lately you've been pretty quick to fire back on fans. And I'm sure you're aware, like people like myself, I'm kind of addicted to just seeing you clap back at some of the idiots. But like, when did you actually like flip the switch and be like, all right, I don't care, I'm going to say what I want to say?
Well, I don't know if I ever flipped the switch. I mean, I'm Italian. I'm from New York. I'm my father's son. There's three things right there that's in my DNA that's going to make me just explode on somebody. I don't know. I mean, I trust me, there are a lot of times I the second I tweet something, I regret it. And I'm like, that was unprofessional. It was immature. It was, you know, why'd you let them get to you and things like that. I think that what the fans need to know, and Joe handles this so much better than me, but when you're constantly, especially when the team stinks, and even though it's not our job to worry if the team stinks or care if the team stinks, when you're constantly inundated with negativity on a constant basis, it just affects you. It just affects you. And if somebody comes at me, and even if I don't strike back then, I'm like, all right, you know, I don't care. It bothers you for the rest of the day. And then eventually something happens that makes me finally reply. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I will say this. So I met, I was in Vegas. And if this police officer is watching this, he's going to remember this story. And I wish I can remember his name. But I was in Vegas a couple weeks ago, and I went downstairs to meet up with Liam Ogren's family, and wound up running into like Pierre-Marc Bouchard while I was with this cop. But this cop comes over to me. He's been a Vegas cop for 25 years, but he's originally from Minnesota. Huge Wild fan, huge Minnesota sports fan, and he follows me on Twitter. And he gave me a pep talk that day. He's like, I got to tell you, you know, you've got to stop letting these people get to you. No, don't go back. You're giving them, like, he was just giving me this pep talk. I actually left him. I hope he's watching this because I never got to tell him. But like, I actually left him, and for like 5 days, I was thinking about this conversation. And when people would come at me on Twitter about something with the team, like I had this guy's head in my thing. Like, this police officer told me not to fight back, to let you know that I'm going to make them win basically if I do it. So I thank that guy, and I'll make sure that I 100% try to act on my best behavior, even though I can't always guarantee that I will.
Speaking of feedback we get all the time, I think we've joked that we have a bunch of GMs in our comment section of our stories a lot of times and know what to do. And one of them is regarding the topic of Marco Rossi, one near and dear to Scott's heart here. The idea that potentially he could be moved this summer is something that I think either understanding or maybe they're a little frustrated about. And Mike, I know both of us, we don't report things unless we think there's a good possibility or there's a reason for it. I want to see if you can put it in perspective for fans of what might lead the Wild to decide to move on from Marco Rossi this summer.
And obviously when we explain this, Joe, it's not like we're endorsing it, you know, because I think you and I have our own feelings on whether or not we think that's accurate. Obviously, if they move Rossi, until we see the return, you can't know if it was a smart move or not. Right now, I think at a basis, when you think of the context of they have a 22-year-old that is only, sorry, my allergies are killing me right now, so I keep on scratching. When you have a 22-year-old that's the second Wild draft pick in history, rookie, to get 20 goals, if I'm not mistaken. And he did that after doing everything they wanted him to do this past offseason to become the player that he was this season. You know, come to Minnesota, invest in being there, work with Matt Harder, work with Andy Ness, and he did everything that they wanted, and then he has this successful season. You're like, how the hell can we wait years and years and years for a young center and watch him be traded, you know, if I'm a Wild fan speaking? The only thing I'll say is that, you know, there's only so many different things that they could do to change the makeup and a lot of this is their own doing because they extended these guys, but they did do it. So it's done. So now it's like, how do they get bigger? How do they get faster? How do they get more dynamic? And Rossi right now, if inside the organization, they're not convinced that he in the future is going to be somebody that they're going to want to pay $7, $8, $9 million to, whatever he's going to develop into, they're just thinking now is probably the good time to maybe move him for somebody that they think is bigger, faster, more dynamic. There's only one way in my eyes that it would make sense, and that is if it is a like-for-like type of trade. So in other words, you have this top 10-ish draft pick that's 22 years old, has scored 21 goals, looks like he's going to be a heck of a player. Can you find somebody on another team that's on the outs there or doesn't want to be there or they're not convinced of as well and maybe do a one-for-one trade? So another top draft pick, another, you know, that type of mold, you know, I'll just say it. I mean, a Kent Johnson, a Marashenko, a Cole Sillinger. The example that Joe and I put in our mailbag is that he and I hear through sources that the Wild made a pitch for Cutter Gauthier earlier this year. Obviously, we do not know what was offered in that move, but that type of trade, a Drysdale for Gauthier trade, is the only way to us that it makes a lot of sense. Unless it's for something huge and he's a big piece in that trade. But as Joe alluded to, there's no way he and I would be so vocal and adamant about this if we didn't have a good feeling that they would at least consider it. We don't throw shit against the wall. It's not either of our styles. And the other thing that I think that we have a track record is that when we write something, it's something that we know is either going on or is probably going to happen.
Yeah. And I mean, I can say for myself, like I use that as a check as well. Like there's a lot of times that I'll have a pretty strong opinion on something. And as soon as you both write differently, I'm like, shit, I got to rethink this. Like first one is, you know, I was kind of shocked when you were discussing on your podcast, Worst Seats in the House, the potential return for Philip Gustavsson. And so, I mean, if a trade is consummated, I'm kind of curious with what you've laid out for potential returns. Is this something that you would expect to happen pre-draft or post-draft?
I think at the draft makes the most sense. I don't know what you think, Joe. That's usually where this type of stuff happens. The other reason why is that if they traded Gus and they didn't get a goalie back in the trade, a real quality number three, on July 1, they are probably going to have to sign somebody. Yep. Because you are then going into next season with Marc-Andre Fleury at 39 years old, turning 40 in November. Coming off a not great year with a, you know, unestablished rookie that, you know, played well against the two lowest scoring teams in the league. So I don't know how much he proved in those two starts against San Jose or Chicago. So I don't know how you can go into it and just be confident with that. So you're going to need to probably sign a Thomas Greitz-like type player, an Antti Raanta type player, you know, like somebody like that, somebody that you're comfortable making your number three in the minors. Not that those guys are really considered AHL, NHL guys, although Raanta was this past season. So that's the only reason, but this stuff usually happens at the draft. And the reason why, again, is that there's probably going to be a draft pick involved. You know, maybe you're trading them for a second. Maybe it's to move up. Maybe it's in some other sort of thing. And that stuff usually happens at the draft. Joe and I are 100% convinced that they are going to try to move them this summer. No doubt about that. We're not 100% convinced that they're going to be able to move him. He's not coming off a great year. There's a lot of goalies out there. So it's not an easy drill. So there could be times next year because they 100% want to get Jesper Wallstedt more games next year. There could be times next year where if Gus is not traded that we suddenly see Wallstedt called up and he gets a string of games. You know, they're going to want to get – so there could be times next year that they have three goalies on the roster. So, you know, maybe Joe has a better sense of what he thinks the return could be.
Yeah, like I just think they're selling at more of a low than you would be of last season. Obviously, his cost certainty with his contract, which isn't bad in a big scheme of things if you get number one goalie at $3.75 million. The question is he legitimately number one goalie? Like he showed flashes of that last year. This year, the consistency was a factor, a problem for him. Like you mentioned, his mental approach was difficult, which is the most important thing for number one goaltender, established consistency. So you're not going to be able to go out there and get a blockbuster. You're not going to get a top flight center for Gustavsson at this point. So you got to be careful of like, hey, you can shop them or you can listen, but if the deal isn't there, you have to feel comfortable going into the next season being like, okay, well, we'll carry these two, we'll carry these three, or bring up Wallstedt and play more games, but don't just give them away for nothing when you have no depth behind these two guys. And if you're saying that goal is ending sunky this season, how's it gonna be any better next season? The guys play three NHL games and Fleury, who quite frankly shouldn't be playing 40 games next year. He'll probably be playing less than that. So you have to keep that in mind if you're going to make a deal with a guy who you know can at least play 50 games. If you're going to say, oh, can I play Wallstedt in the NHL? Sure, but can you play him 40, 45 games right away, not knowing what will happen? So that's why there's such many layers to this move, even though I think that they will shop them and I think they will get some offers. What if it's not an offer that they like and all of a sudden they've boxed themselves into these two guys and Fleury could get injured? You never know. I mean, he's going to be 40 years old and not used to playing probably this much. So it's the most fascinating topic, I think, for the offseason for the Wild.
Yeah, and if you remember at the beginning of the year too, he had some hip issues that he revealed, you know, in the second half of the season. If you remember, he missed some games, some time, and he clearly wasn't feeling great. And so, you know, I mean, look, he's father time always wins. So,
with as far as like the top six, I know we've talked about, you know, what ways can they maybe bolster that and. Either ways is use it via trade, whether that's in a Rossi move or a Gustafson move, or it's in free agency. And just what's your overall feel, Mike, on, we talked about some certain fits in our mailbag for that spot. And is there like a year off factor or prospect factor in this where it's, you don't want to just sign another guy for a multi-year deal when you have these guys coming?
I think that's exactly what's going on, is that I think that they have a big time interest in adding a top six forward. But it's got to be somebody that's willing to probably come on a one-year deal, max two. Now, if you could trade Gustafson for a young rostered player, you know, call a Philadelphia and see if a player, you know, Morgan Frost or somebody, I don't know. You know, like there are ways to go about it if you're getting somebody that's really young and has a potential future. But if you were talking in free agency, it's going to be somebody that's willing to take a 1-2 year deal. By virtue of free agency, most anybody is going to want term. Patrick Kane wants term. Jonathan Marchessault is going to want term. David Perron is going to want term. What you got to hope is that you could convince one of those guys or somebody, not one of those, I don't think Kane or Marchessault, there's any chance, but like a Perron, that he would be willing to sign a one-year deal at 3.5 or 4 or whatever it is. They still don't have unlimited cap space this summer, especially with Rossi's bonus overage that's going to occur. They've already lost 425 on top of their 14.7 next year, and it could be another $218,000 that they're losing on top of that if he's on the all-rookie team. So suddenly their 6-7 is now down to 6-1. And so they just don't have an unlimited amount of time. And remember, part of that 6-1 is re-signing Chisholm. It's bonus overages, potential for Ogren and Kuznetsov, or Wahlstedt if he's on the team. So there's just a lot of complexities here. That they are going to have to deal with. So it's going to have to be a veteran. It's going to have to be somebody. And the reason that you alluded to, Joe, is that because their hope is it's biding time for a Danilo Yurov to come over in a year and take one of those spots, or Riley Height to either make the team now or come or be able to debut in a year. So that's the big reason why, you know, Anthony and I got into that brawl on the pod the other day, because he's just wrong. They're not signing anybody to a 4x4, 5x5. They don't have the cap space, and they don't have the desire to do that. They are going to – they've already signed Hartman, Zuccarello, and Foligno for at least the next 4 years for one of them, 2 years for another, 3 for another. But now they've got to have create not only spaces but roles for a Riley Height, a Yurov, an Ogren to not be the fourth – like Ogren might be the fourth line left wing next year, but there's going to have to come a point where you're going to elevate him up in the lineup.
Yeah, and shout out Barrel Theory. We were going to actually address that in our hot take segment, but we might as well talk about it now. I mean, Anthony, again, I know he is with you that it's probably going to go the path of signing someone short term, but really convinced that there is a possibility you could sign someone to like a 4 or 5 year deal. Are there even players out there that you'd be interested in pursuing for that type of deal if it wasn't a matter of boxing out prospects?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's guys like Mantha and Toffoli, I think, is available, and players like that, that it would take that type of thing. And that's just, it's not something that I think they're willing to do or should do or can do. I think it's just obvious. I don't think, and that's kind of where my frustration with him lied the other night, is that Joe and I, we know what's going on. We are talking to the people that are sort of, you know, the decision makers, and then can, from what they say, sort of come to our own conclusions of what makes sense or what the tact is going to be here. And so that was my only frustration the other day, is like, I'm telling you what they're going to do. I don't care what you think they can do. They're not doing it. This is what they're going to do. And the reason why is this: they have to have room for Riley Height. They have to have room for Danilo Yurov. And to go back to the Rossi thing, And this is, again, I know it confuses a lot of people, is that if they think Yurov is going to be, and we know X here long-term, is going to be their first or second-line center for the foreseeable future. If they think Height could be a second-line center or play wing, again, there's only so many spots here. So, like, that's another reason why if they just are not convinced that Rossi is a guy that's going to be better than, say, those players or somebody they could acquire, that would be the reason to make those moves in that move, in their opinion. They are not going to go out and sign a 32-year-old like a Jonathan Marchessault, as much as I would love it, to a 6-year time six deal, you know, to get your off. You know, they're not going to sign unless Stamkos is coming here at 1 year at 3.5, Joe, it's just not working. So yeah,
it's not going
to
work.
These guys, I mean, free agents, when they get to 32, they don't know how many contracts they have left. Mm-hmm. So they're not signing. They're not just going to on day one say, all right, yeah, I'll come to Minnesota for what, you know, for why.
1 year.
You know, they're trying to maximize their deal there. So, yeah.
It's one of the more weird seasons I've been around, even though it wasn't really exciting on the ice. But the first half of the season, like, I don't know, you've been around this league longer than I have, to have a coach firing, to have an assistant GM depart ways with the organization, to have the head person of your organization, Bill Guerin, investigated in an HR manner, you know, team travel services guy, Andrew Height, left the organization. And I think people ask us in the mailbag all the time or Twitter, like, you know, what's going on, or is there more updates, or what can't you tell us? And I think people don't understand kind of our business and how it works and what things we might know versus what things we can actually report. And I wanted to see if you could maybe answer that to some fans of, like, hey, this is a little more complicated issue than just me spitballing with you on Twitter about what we think we might know.
Yeah, exactly. First of all, everything you just said happened in a span of a week. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, in John Hines's first month on the job, I don't think he saw Bill Guerin. So, I mean, you know, like, he was basically, you know, gone. And he lost his team services guy and found out the assistant GM that was right there when he was hired was fired. You know, I mean, look, I think that you and I have a lot of pride in the job that we do, and we want to report everything that we know to the fans. And I think it's a bane of our existence that we haven't been able to tell people exactly what's going on here. There's a lot of complexities to the matter. In the Andrew Height situation, he signed a non-disclosure agreement. So he's not talking publicly. And so there's just only so many things that we could report from that. People, let's be honest, the only reason why people know that he's even gone from the organization is because what you and I reported. You know, and we, to the best of our ability, told you what it was for, that there was a fight, a verbal argument between Bill Guerin and Andrew Height, and he went to HR about it, and it was essentially Bill stays or Andrew Height stays. They did a behind the scenes investigation, and the team chose clearly Bill. Now, I will say Andrew had the ability to stay, but didn't want to stay in that environment and left with a separation package and signed an NDA. So that's just the extent of really what we could fire, what we could report on there. There were stuff behind the scenes that was investigated with Bill Guerin. The NHLPA looked into it. The NHLPA talked to different players, and the NHLPA has told us there's nothing further to this matter. So unless the NHLPA is going to say, basically, go public here, there's nothing that we can write more on that. The Chris O'Hearn thing is one that frustrates me all the time. We think that we know what happened. We know what it was about. But there's just so many holes to the story that's impossible to report that we just can't report it. So, I mean, it's that simple. We don't know how it was found out. We don't know who made the wild fire him. We don't know what the investigate. Like, there's just too much, you know, like, we can't just say we know it was that he left because of this broad reason, right? You know, really, you know, like, we can't do it. And so and it's just, and the other thing is that he's so respected by people inside the Wild that obviously they're not talking. They're protecting him. They don't want his career to end because of this. This thing that happened has nothing to do with any personal conduct or anything like that. He just made a mistake in his job, and it was, and in the league's mind and clearly the Wild's mind, it was fireable. But it's not something that, like, I'd love to report it, trust me. And it's just not something that we can, because there's just 1,000 holes to it, and it's just right now, it's impossible to get out there.
And the story might come out eventually, but it's hard to, you can't just do bits and pieces. Like, I heard a little bit about this, and it's not a 140 character kind of context. You can't just.
He's not talking to, he signed an NDA. So like, it's just, you know, once people sign those things, I mean, you know, they, it just becomes a lot more difficult for us to do the job. And especially in the standpoint of Chris, who is so liked and respected inside the organization, it's like everybody is just, you know, the people that do know, which are very, very few people inside the organization, very few. I mean, trust me, they're just not willing to do it, you know, say anything. So it's just, you know, it's just, I trust me, I if I was a fan and didn't know all this context, I'd be looking at you two, at you and I, and be like, what, like, we deserve to know. And I think you do deserve to know. The assistant GM was fired in December, a guy that the night before he was let go, we were in Seattle and I had dinner with at the press room table, and he clearly had no idea that this was going on behind the scenes, because he was, you know, we were joking around about John Lazzard and Connor Dewar making their NHL debut in Seattle a couple of years ago, and things like that. Like, it just, like, trust me, I'd love to report it. It's just, unfortunately, you know, you just can't.
Any timeline for filling those vacancies?
Yeah, I think it's going to happen. I think Bill Guerin knows what he wants to do. My gut says it's going to be a couple people. One that's sort of like, you know, on the hockey side, and the other more like a contract negotiator, analytics. So sort of like a lot of teams do, is, you know, a kind of a multi-pronged split the responsibilities up. So usually the way this stuff works is that next week the organization has a retreat with Craig Leopold. And usually the people at that are Jeff Pellegrin, their chief financial officer, Matt Naka, their CEO, Bill Guerin, the president of Hockey Ops and GM, and Craig Leopold. And they meet somewhere, and they not only go over the plan for next year, but they go over the budget. And I think that if they're doing what I'm sensing they're going to do and have multiple assistant GMs, that changes the budget of maybe what Bill Guerin's front office would be. And if that's the case, then, you know, you sort of need approval from that, from Pellegrin and Craig Leopold. So my gut says that, you know, at some point, you know, early to mid-May, we'll have a good sense of what happens. You know, I'm sure Bill, I would hope that Bill's looking outside the organization, but I know that there's a couple people inside the organization that he has great respect for that he might look at promoting. You know, Matt Sells is somebody that has just skyrocketed up the chain, you know, started off as an analytics guy, became their VP there. And this year, without Chris O'Hearn there, he's been negotiating contracts and really working their cap. And he makes a lot of sense to me. You know, another guy that makes a ton of sense to me is Chris Kelleher, because he's the director of player personnel. He's been with his organization 17 years, hired originally by Doug Risebrow. And he's very tight with Bill Guerin, so much so that he's also the director of player personnel for the Four Nations face-off and the Olympics for the USA hockey team that Bill Guerin's running. So those are two potential internal candidates. And then I know that Joe and I always feel that, you know, it's never a bad idea to look outside the organization and try to get fresh ideas.
I know we've run a little long here, Mike, so let me just know when you need to go. I know you're after the morning skate. Do you have time for one or two more, or what's your time range here?
A couple more, because I do have a couple text messages I have to get back of, one that you're going to be interested to know about.
So. I'll ask one, and then Scott can give the our typical one that we always with a little twist for you, since we know you're not a big golf guy. One thing we're both reporting talking about is Iowa and the prospects. People care about prospects a lot in the future of this organization. We both were at the end of the year presser with Bill and them talking about how important it is to create depth in the organization. I guess, what are maybe the biggest concerns you think you have, or the fans probably should have, about what's going on in the developmental system or with Iowa? And I'll have a big story on this coming out in the next couple of weeks about spending time there and learning about it, but just from a depth perspective and guys coming up, what are the biggest concerns there?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think the biggest concern is just the development of these young defensemen. You know, I think a lot of us have thought that that was actually a strength of the organization a couple of years ago, because they had so many of these kids. You know, Lampos in the first round, O'Rourke in the second round, Damon Hunt in the third round, Simon Johansson, Masters, Jack Peart, second round pick, and obviously Jack just turned pro, but it just doesn't seem like any of these guys are even close to the NHL, maybe Damon Hunt being the closest. But in a lot of ways, that's sort of an indictment of where Lambos and O'Rourke have gone. You know, David Spachek is another. who spent a lot of this year in the ECHL. So they are a long ways off. And I think that's just the concern is, you know, did they swing and miss with the draft picks? Were they never going to be NHL prospects, or have they, you know, the development not just gone the way that the Wild had hoped? So that's one. You know, I can't wait to see a Hunter Haight join there. You know, maybe Ogrinen, who's on DNF, get some time there. We'll see next year. But they're going to start to get a little more infusion of forwards in the next couple of years. Rieger Lorenz, you know, people like that eventually you're going to sign. And so that would be my concern. The other thing here is that clearly a lot of the guys that they called up this year, whether it was Adam Beckman or Sammy Walker, whether it was even a lot of the guys that spent a lot of the year in Minnesota, they didn't make nearly the impact that the Wild had hoped. And so they've got to look at that as getting sort of, you know, better players that you could put in Iowa that then when John Hines needs a top six forward or somebody to play the power play or this role on the fourth line or the third line, that they are sit there and hey, he has three or four options and can say, I want that guy and I'm going to put him in that spot and that they'll just be better. Now, that's not easy. That's sometimes easier said than done, right? I mean, they, you know, by definition, if they're that good, they're probably going to be on NHL contracts. I could see the Wild this offseason trying to sign some guys to one-way contracts that they are actually going to prepare. Or you know, I think people are going to look at it as like one-way contracts, so they're going to be in Minnesota. I think what the Wild are actually going to be doing is looking to sign guys to expensive contracts, knowing that they're probably going to clear waivers in late September, and they're going to be down in Iowa, and then you could call them up. Dujar Carr is an example of that. You know, he's somebody they signed to a one-year, one-way. Actually, it was a two-way. Either way, he was an NHL veteran. They put him down in the minors. Then he got hurt, and they weren't able to ever use him except for really one game in Philly where he was an absolute disaster for them. I mean, just couldn't even put on the ice after one shift. He was so bad. So that didn't work. But somebody like that. And there are players that, like, you know, who's the kid on Tampa that cleared through waivers a couple years ago? Essamont? Yeah. You know, Stefan Nosen, like those type of players have cleared waivers and now they're regular NHL guys. And so they're going to try to find those guys, stack them in Iowa. And then when you feel like you need somebody, you call them up and they're going to be actually better.
Two quick ones here, Mike. These ones are to pay the bills. I'll give you guys one that you can carve me for here. It's a hot take for Barrel Theory that I'll have a couple questions, I guess, that kind of stem off of it. But I might be the only person in Minnesota that does not enjoy the reverse retro jerseys. I just do not like the green and yellow combination. All I see
I'm with you, man.
Green Bay. Like, I hate it. So I'm terrified that they're going to make a pivot to having that be their regular jersey here in the next couple of years. I don't know if you guys know anything about plans there, but if so, do you guys agree with me if they go that route? They got to change the logo. Like the Wild logo today, just being green and yellow, just doesn't look right.
Look, I'm with you. I don't like them. I mean, I've said that. I like the whites a lot better, but I also think their white road uniform right now is as sharp as there is in the league. I love it. Like when you see it close up and you're at a morning skate, they are sweet.
I like Iowa's better.
Yeah. Actually I like the off white and all that. I will like to me, I'd be shocked if they go to it full time because I will say that the one thing, like, say what you want. I mean, fans can have their opinions, but the Wild uniforms are near the highest sellers in the league. And as long as that continues to be, I don't see the Wild changing anything and doing a rebrand. That's just a fact. And so, but you know, like I've never been known for my fashion statement. Like I loved the red Christmas jerseys. You sure. know, I was having, I talked to Marcus Foligno about those jerseys for 10 minutes at a morning skate this year. We both wish it came back as their full-time jersey. Like it's, they're awesome in my eyes, but I remember on Twitter, people like, the Christmas jerseys, they suck, you know, like, and I don't know. I hope they don't change them.
I like the home green jerseys a lot. I like them. So I don't mind. I like the sharp look of the third one, but I don't think there should be a full-time one. So I don't think I'm anti against it.
Or make it more North Stars, like throw some black trim in there or something. Like I just think it looks it really like to me looks like a Subway jersey.
Subway, Green Bay, Dinah, I don't care what it is. Yeah. All right. Then the last one that we'll kind of adapt for you, because I'm sure like me, not as much of a golfer as some of the people we've had on for interviews. We usually for our good friends at Waggle Golf, go to getyourwaggleon.com, use promo code SP10 to take 10% off your entire order. We're usually asking for their dream golf foursome. For you, I'm going to say if you could grab three other guys and post up for a couple hours in a cigar lounge, who are you picking? Dead, alive, doesn't matter what their background is.
I would say Larry David would be fun. I don't think he'd be somebody that would smoke a cigar. My favorite baseball player growing up was Tim Wallach, and I'd love to just hang out with him and chat with him for a while. I've gotten to meet him a couple times, many times actually when I was a kid, but a couple times when he was third base coach for the Dodgers when I was covering actually once when I was covering the Marlins in 05, and another time when I was covering the Wild and I happened to be at an Arizona Residence Inn having breakfast, and all of a sudden I realized it was the Dodgers hotel during spring training, and I sat with them and had breakfast. So that was a thrill. So there you go. So that's two. Another one. It's got to be a singer. I'm such a huge music fan.
And no, the entire Trampled by Turtles group doesn't count as one.
Yeah, I know. And I don't know if they're big cigar guys. It would shock me if they smoked, but I don't think big cigar guys. I don't know. I'm a big REM fan. Like somebody like Michael Stipe would be neat. Bono, somebody like that. Yeah. I don't know. This is probably as lame as you've ever had as the final one. I'll get off this later, and it'll be like Twitter when I'm angry at somebody. All of a sudden, like 2 hours from now, I'll be like, "God damn it!" And I'm gonna text Joe and be like, "Can we do this one segment one more time?
Just retape it again."
Yeah, from the top. But no, I think Larry David's a great pick.
Yeah, I would love to meet Seinfeld too. Like I've seen his show live.
You guys at Oscar.
Oh my God. And I don't know if you watched, like, I think it's season 7 of Curb where they did the Seinfeld reunion that entire season. And you know, if you know anything about Curb Your Enthusiasm, everything's improvised. They have, an outline, and that entire season, you could just see what it's like to be in a room with Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David just riffing off each other, because there are times where they are hysterically laughing and you could just tell it wasn't written in a script. And I think it would be awesome to have like Larry there, Jerry there, and just have them just chatting away and a little stogie and a glass of scotch. So all right.
Jerry can be an add-in. We're okay with it.
Yeah.
But thanks so much for joining us. A lot of fun. And I know you have a lot of work to do here with the Rangers and Capitals series. I think he'll probably be going to South Florida, the Panthers do on beat the Lightning. It's fun to go a little bit behind the curtain here on how we cover the Wild and what's going on, but should be a fun summer for a few of us.
For Russo anyway. Yeah. I heard you're going to be a bum and you're not really going to do any work.
Yeah. Maybe starting mid June, I might be a little bit on a siesta, but I'm hoping there'll be some more siestas from our new baby. He'll be sleeping a lot, but we'll see.
Thanks for putting the senior citizen filter on my face during this episode. I really appreciate that.
Yes. And don't worry, next time we'll make sure we don't use that filter for you. Promise.
Yeah. At least now I know what I'll look like in 20 years. Because I know this isn't now.
So. No, absolutely not. Perfect. Well, thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
All right. See you guys.